WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Carl Hiaasen's official bio says that he was born, raised, and still lives in what's left of South Florida. Hiaasen has worked at the Miami Herald since 1976, first as a reporter and now as a columnist. He's also written a number of detective novels. While his column lets him rail against greedy developers and corrupt politicians, his fiction gives him a chance to rewrite the news stories that come across his desk and give them happy endings. His new novel is called Native Tongue. It takes place in a familiar Florida setting, a tacky theme park.
You live in Florida and you write about tourism in the business industry in Florida, and you write about theme parks. Everybody and their grandmother's got a theme park, and of course, Disney World is the ultimate theme park. And years ago, I had gone and done some work on lawsuits that had been filed against Disney World because I thought it would be kind of funny to see what kind of things happen that we don't hear about normally at Disney World, which is sort of this hermetic Android, Stepford Wives sort of atmosphere. So I thought it would be fun to see what was really happening. And there was some fantastically funny lawsuits.
Like what?
Well, there was one that sticks in my mind. It was either Pluto or Goofy, and I get those two mixed up, so you'll have to forgive me. But it was during the Main Street Parade, which is like the culmination of the big festivities every day at Disney World. They have a Main Street Parade. All the characters come out, and Mickey and Minnie, everyone sings and dances. Well, I guess on this particular day, it was either Goofy or Pluto. It had a really, what you would call a bad day at the office, apparently. And he's prancing and dancing down Main Street, USA, and some little kid comes out and tugs on his tail. And the allegation of the lawsuit was that Pluto or Goofy then turned and drop-kicked the kid right across the parking lot. And I thought to myself, this is wonderful because reality has intruded. I mean, that's the sort of thing I would pay to see as a tourist. I mean, forget the parade. That's funny. I mean, nobody was injured. I mean, there were some allegations that the kid was traumatized and that, he was going to grow up to be a sniper or something. But the fact of the matter is, it was just sort of one of many, many very weird, their people had expired, for example, on a couple of the rides. Now, you have to then prove were the rides the cause of the death or not. And I know that's not funny, but in many cases, there were not rides that you would expect someone to particularly die on. So I got some ideas from that. I thought, now, what if you had a theme park that wasn't as careful as Disney World? What if you had a theme park that was sort of a cut-rate Disney, where the engineering talent probably wasn't quite up to snuff with what Disney would have used? And that was my idea for Native Tongue and creating this theme park in that book.
I must say, from my limited experience in Disney World, it's the only city I've ever visited where I want graffiti and garbage.
Right, you do. You have this longing for some sort of, as I said, reality, something to happen that isn't planned, that's spontaneous, that's fun without being orchestrated fun. And that's why all of us who live in Florida, and especially people who live in Orlando, kind of get a little bit of a kick out of it when something happens at Disney World. I don't mean it's something catastrophic, but something that they can't control. A few years ago, the place was invaded by black vultures who had been moved out of their native habitat. And so, like everyone else, they thought Disney World looked pretty darn good. But, of course, black vultures don't exactly fit in with the Main Street Parade, sort of harmony. And there was a great scandal because some of the vultures were confronted in a rather violent way by Disney employees. And, but I mean, to me, all of us in Florida sat back and laughed and said, okay, there you go, deal with that.
Well, you even say in your book you seem to imply that Disney World is a much more insidious form of entertainment. You write, let me read this. The mouse's sprawling self-contained empire sucked tourist pockets inside out. They came, they spent until there was nothing left to spend. Then they went home happy. To lifelong Floridians, it was a dream concept, fleecing a snowbird in such a way that he came back for more. Astounding. Are you speaking for all Floridians?
I think I'm speaking for many Floridians because it is an incredible concept that people come, and Disney is so shrewd that they have taken care of, literally from the time you step off the plane to the airport, I mean, you are in their clutches, both emotionally and otherwise, I mean, and they, the food, your hotel, if you want, your every form of transportation, if you want to play golf, there's nothing that you want to do that they can't arrange and that they'll be very happy to take your money for. And that, after all, is what the tourist industry is all about. So we in South Florida have always looked upon that that strategy with great envy, because it seemed to us for a long time down in Miami and Fort Lauderdale that Disney World in Orlando was sucking all our family tourist business away. I mean, they had just literally drawn almost a line across the state below which tourists need not go anymore. And so there is sort of a jealousy and inferiority complex that we live with down there.
Your protagonist, Joe Winder, is an investigative journalist who works in the public relations department at a rival theme park to Disney World called the Amazing Kingdom of Thrills, right, which is located in South Florida. Is that your greatest fear, that somehow, as a journalist, you're going to end up putting out cheerful press releases for some corporation?
There is a high burnout factor in journalism. There really is. It's hard to last a long time and keep your sanity and keep a normal family life and all that. And so in corporations, big ones, are always in the market for experienced journalists to come work in public relations, because journalists know how other journalists think and how they can be not just manipulated, but also to be made comfortable. I mean, if you know how newspapers and TV stations and radio stations work, then it helps when you're dealing with those people to have someone who with some expertise and background in it. So I think that for a lot of reporters, particularly with myself, with my background is in investigations, and for me to wind up in a place like that would sort of be tough on, I think, my pride and ego for a while, and that's what's going on with Joe.
Carl Hyacin is my guest. He's an investigative journalist and a columnist for the Miami Herald, and he's written a number of novels. His latest book is called Native Tongue. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Novelist and journalist Carl Hyacin is my guest. You seem to be very attracted to rather convoluted plots. We have in this book an eco-terrorist. We have a blue-tongued mango vole.
An endangered species
stolen from the park. The president of the theme park is hiding out in the witness protection program. Winder's girlfriend is a phone sex operator. There's a roadkill gourmet. There's a kind of oversexed dolphin. What do you have against simplicity of storyline?
Oh, I think the story is simple. I think the characters are a little complicated. I live in a place where there are no simple stories, and so I don't write simple stories. I mean, nothing is as it seems in South Florida, so I'm not used to a simple linear storytelling mode. I mean, I put as many interesting characters as I can into the novels because I like people to be sort of intrigued and want to find out how did they get that way. I mean, how does a former governor of Florida wind up living in the swamp eating roadkill? And I mean, these are not just demented figments of imagination. They're all inspired by an event or a person or something that, you know, that really, really happened.
Well, I must say also in your novels that many of your characters meet strange and violent deaths. There is a killer whale that expires eating a park employee. A president of the Greater Miami Chamber of Commerce is chopped up and put in a suitcase, strangled by a rubber alligator.
Well, that's just a personal fantasy of mine.
Let me go on here. There's a composting accident. There's a woman in a condo eaten by a crocodile. Is this a window into your fantasy life?
Well, I got to say that when in Florida, growing up in Florida and seeing it's a place of immense beauty and just incredible natural power, nature still has a pretty strong hand. And despite our best efforts to pave it over and neutralize it, that nature occasionally strikes back. And I always root for nature in those circumstances. When a crocodile comes in contact with a human being and does what crocodiles tend to do, which is eat, I have to say I end up rooting for the crocodile most of the time. It's just part of it is watching the encroachment and the disappearance of a place that was very precious to me as a kid and isn't around anymore. And so I sort of end up rooting for nature. I mean, I don't entirely fear the idea of a big hurricane. I think there are benefits to rearranging the skyline a little bit in downtown Miami.
Now, your critics say that you hate Florida, and that's why you say all these terrible things about the people who live there.
No, I love Florida. I just hate what they've done to it.
Well, what And I know that you grew up there. You're probably one of the few people that can say you were actually born in Florida. You only live a couple of doors from where you did grow up,
right,
outside of Fort Lauderdale. What's the Florida of your youth?
Well, it was still a place where you could, you know, get on your bicycle if you were a kid. And literally, I was within riding distance of the edge of the Everglades. And you go out there and you fish and you catch snakes and critters. And you, as far as the eye can see, you see nothing but swamp and nothing but green. And now you see nothing but concrete. And I don't think that's an experience that's unique to Florida by any means. I get letters from people all over the country who've read the books, who have experienced the same pain and the same sick feeling in their gut when they go home and they see something that's happened in their hometown to a place that they had fond memories of. There's nothing unique about the experience, but in Florida, it is the predominant experience of people that have grown up there to see a change, and it's happened very rapidly and with great cataclysmic effects on the environment. To the point now that this is a state where the state mammal, which is the Florida panther, is now nearly extinct. The state sea mammal, which is the manatee, is down to the last couple hundred. The state fish, the largemouth bass, is inedible due to mercury poisoning. I mean, it's a pretty sad legacy. It's the kiss of death to make something the official state creature of Florida, I guess.
You have suggested that a hurricane could fix a lot of what was wrong with Florida, and the mayor of Miami demanded that you apologize to the entire human race for your words. Have you? Did you?
No, and I won't. And I mean, I'll include him in that particular category. I'll be generous today and include him. But no, I didn't. I don't intend to apologize. And what I said, in fact, was that on any given day, if you're sitting there in a bad mood, sitting in traffic on I-95, that you start to begin to wonder, you know, of the possible purging effect of a hurricane. And I say that because I think all of us who live in a little tiny tropical peninsula like that need to be reminded of nature's power occasionally, and to be reminded that we don't own this, we don't have a monopoly on this particular little beautiful stretch of America, that we are, you know, really holding it in trust for our kids and our grandkids and for all the generations to follow. And we've got to start taking care of it a little bit. And so I don't exactly have the same trepidation. I mean, I think I certainly don't advocate great loss of life, but I would like to see some of the architecture taken care of. But I think a storm could do that nicely.
Are you going to have to choose at some point between your writing as a journalist and your writing as a novelist?
Oh, probably, yeah. It just gets too hard to juggle. It's such two completely different disciplines, and the books are becoming more and more consuming, and which is, I'm flattered, and it's wonderful, but there, at some point, I think either you go insane trying to do both. And there are very few columnists. I mean, Jimmy Breslin writes novels, and he writes nonfiction while he's doing the column. So does Pete Dexter. So do a few others. But it's a very hard thing to balance, very tricky thing to balance without completely running yourself into the ground. And I guess if I had to choose, you know, and I probably will someday, I'll probably end up writing the books. And the inspiration is, I would miss, you know, I would miss being in the energy of the newsroom is tremendous. You're around talented people, some of them very crazy people, but nonetheless, it's a fun environment, and you draw a lot of inspiration and a lot of ideas from that as a writer, and that would be hard not to have. But on the other hand, you know, there comes a point, sort of a saturation point, too.
Where do you go on vacation, since everyone comes to Florida?
Where I go, I try to go to Montana once a year, which is, you know, beautiful and largely unpopulated. I try to pick the states where the population's actually declining and then go there and float the rivers in Montana. I spend a lot of time in the Keys, which are still quite pretty if you know where to go, the Florida Keys, and you know where to go and you know where to hide. And I'm not just talking about the tourists, but from the general population increase down there. But there are enough islands to get lost in down there that if you got a boat, you can get away from it. And I spend a lot of time down there in Everglades National Park and in that area. And there are still places to go where you will not see another boat the whole day. And that's kind of not very many places you can say that about.
Now, see, I would think people hearing you would say, hey, let's go to Florida, and you're going to get another whole packload of tourists.
Well, I think as soon as they get the first cloud of mosquitoes going down their clothes, they may reconsider, because there's nothing like an Everglades Park mosquito early in the morning to make you wish you were somewhere else.
Carl Hiaasen, thank you very much for joining us today. Carl Hiaasen is a columnist for the Miami Herald and the author of the new novel, Native Tongue. This is Fresh Air.